the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce magazine. The first articles I want to read for you are from a section called Breadwinners. Getting a job outside the home gave women a chance to pitch in. Still in charge of households, their plates were full. And the first article is titled, Nights Without Mom. Accident forces family to make a major shift, and this is submitted by Annette Kachera of Brookfield, Ohio. Our house in Niles, Ohio was immaculate in the 1940s. Our mom, Mary, who was from Italy, was the embodiment of the stay-at-home wife and mother. She stretched every dollar by purchasing fabric and sewing our clothes and buying eggs and poultry at bargain prices while still serving wonderful meals. Through her careful management, she and our dad, Carmen, who also was born in Italy, were able to meet required costs for our simple lifestyle. But in 1948, Dad was involved in a car accident. He was uninsured and was found liable for causing damage to three other cars. Soon my parents had insurmountable expenses. I'd heard of people ending up in the poorhouse, and I thought our family was headed there. Packard Electric in Warren, Ohio, was a successful company that manufactured auto parts. The mother of the family who lived next door worked there, and Mom confided our troubles to her. She arranged an interview for Mom, and to our surprise and delight, our stay-at-home mom was hired to work on one of the auto parts lines. By the fall of 1948, our family had a new routine to accommodate Mom's second shift schedule. She got us ready for school and made supper so Dad could heat it up when he got home from his job at Stevens Metal Products in Niles. Brother Carmen was 7, and I was 9. Sis Teresa, 12, was our supervisor and assisted us when we needed help. On winter evenings, Sis popped corn for us and made Hershey hot cocoa as Mom had done. In the summer evenings, Dad would make a fire outside and let us roast wieners and marshmallows. We'd play until dusk when his shrill whistle called us home. We couldn't avoid some mishaps without Mom there to help us. I once burned a hole in a new nylon dress as I was ironing it, and another time I accidentally put a slit in a tablecloth while I was working on a science project. We also got away with things that Mom might have prevented. I found and opened the Christmas presents that Mom had hidden under my parents' bed, although I tried to rewrap them. Once I ate an entire bunch of bananas, and another time practiced my cooking skills by frying sunny-side-up eggs. So much for Sis's supervision. By 1951, we were used to managing without Mom. We still missed her presence at school events and wished for her during emergencies, but our improvising had paid off. Mom handed over her paychecks, keeping only $20 for herself until my parents were debt-free. After that, she kept all but $20 for herself. She modernized to fit in with her co-workers, painting her nails and perming her hair. Those nights without Mom required cooperation from every family member, but Mom gets the credit for the biggest transformation. Our secluded, demure mother showed great courage and an ability to adapt when she entered the workforce at middle age and emerged as the savior of our family. And the next article from the Breadwinner section is titled, In the Spotlight, Big City Job Kept Young Graduate on Her Toes, and this is submitted by Donna Tanner of Ocala, Florida. When I graduated from high school in Mount Hope, West Virginia in 1966, many of the students had their futures already planned. Some of my classmates' parents could afford to send them to college, and some boys were drafted and went to Vietnam. For girls, we had few options besides teaching and nursing, and many opted to get married and start families, but none of those things were for me. After a long job search, I found work at a dry cleaner's. I made 75 cents an hour and knew that men made more. One year later, after saving every penny I could gather, I was on a Greyhound bus headed to Chicago, Illinois. Then from the country, I found the huge city overwhelming at first. I moved into an apartment and got a job at Maybelline, which was headquartered in Chicago. I worked there for a year, then I was ready to move on. I found a good job at another well-known Chicago firm, Bell and Howell. The company was known for its audio-visual technology, home movie cameras, projectors, tape recorders, and instant cameras. I was excited to be hired as an inspector in the home movie department, which paid very well. I started work on a warm April day, a no-jacket day. New to the routines of my workplace, I skipped lunch and went outside. No one was around, and I leaned against a car to enjoy the spring sunshine. Suddenly, I saw my new supervisor and his boss coming toward me. I thought, it was nice working here for half a day. They were carrying a large movie camera and a microphone, and my supervisor instructed me to talk into the microphone while they recorded me. It seemed as if all I said was blah, 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 but I did manage to talk about how nice the weather was that day. When they finished recording me, they explained they had a new prototype of a sound home movie camera. It was a video camera. Their recording of me was for a demonstration of the new product. After they thanked me and left, I felt only relief that I hadn't been fired on my first day after all. A month or so later, I learned that my recording turned out well. The new cameras were popular, and I got a generous bonus in my paycheck as a thank you. I loved living in Chicago. It was a great place to work, and I always found something new to explore. Eventually, I married and had two children, a daughter and a son. But the adventure of working and living on my own in the city, when such a life was not quite as acceptable for a single woman as it is now, has always given me a satisfying sense of pride and independence. And now I have for you some additional information that goes with the breadwinner articles I just read for you, and this is titled Woman Power versus Technology. Women had more freedom than ever to work for a paycheck in the 1960s and 70s, an opportunity at odds with the notion that the level of housekeeping would stay the same when they got a job. Working and stay-at-home women embraced self-cleaning, easy care, and frost-free innovations and were more than happy to put away the elbow grease. Dishwashers. Say goodbye to dishpan hands. Available as a luxury appliance in the 60s, dishwashers came down in price to become a kitchen standard by the end of the 1970s. Self-cleaning ovens. Scraping the crud out of a dirty oven was the worst job in the kitchen. In 1963, General Electric promised relief from the drudgery of scouring and harsh chemicals. Simply set the dial and burn those oven spills to a crisp. Garbage disposals. Some families put Fido on garbage duty, but disposals work better. Introduced in the 1920s, they became more prevalent in the 60s when InSinkErator hit on the idea of marketing them as a thoughtful gift. Bigger refrigerators. Colorful refrigerators with new frost-free technology were the pride of the kitchen in the 50s. In the 60s, fridges got bigger, which meant fewer trips to the grocery store. No wax flooring. Unlike linoleum, the resilient finish on vinyl, widely available in the 1960s, did not regularly require the hands and knees work of resealing with liquid wax. Add to that vinyl's modern colors, and the choice was easy. Linoleum was out, vinyl was in. And lastly, frozen foods. Those big fridges also had expanded freezer compartments to keep up with the appetite for frozen convenience food, such as TV dinners, which became a staple. Marking the 60th anniversary of the Peace Corps, volunteers recall the hope and ideals that urged them into a life-changing experience. And our first story is submitted by Mia Kubler of Clarence, New York, and her article is titled, A Different Path. In 1961, when President John F. Kennedy formed the Peace Corps, I was 17. The concepts on which the Corps was based drew my attention from the beginning. In spring 1965, my graduation from Marquette University imminent, Nothing drew my interest more than the Peace Corps, to my parents' dismay. That August, I began training for Peace Corps groups going to Mysore State and Maharashtra State in western central India. Our training covered public health, including nutrition, latrine building, poultry raising, kitchen gardening, and many other healthy living skills. In addition, we studied the area's language and culture for several hours a day. Our teachers were from the states where we would be assigned. My experience working on a public health project at two villages could be frustrating because of the government bureaucracy, and village problems were numerous and seemed overwhelming. But the rewards and personal relationships and insights on the world were rich and profoundly moving. As an American, a woman, and a person of faith, I am who I am today in great measure because of those 2 years living with the villagers in India who welcomed me into their lives. Our cook, the errand runner from the health center, the female leaders from the county level, and the doctor who had a practice in the village. So many kind people had an impact on my life. And of course, my fellow volunteers who put their hearts, souls, and skills into helping to change the serious health outcomes of villagers. I look back to almost 60 years ago, and I wish that I had done more, that I had more knowledge, energy, and time back then to effect true change. But I am grateful I chose to go on the adventure. We earned 11 cents an hour for 2 years, but we had an experience like no other. Without a doubt, the volunteers felt the greatest impact of the journey. India changed us more than we changed India. The next article about the Peace Corps is submitted by Ronald Pitt of Elgin, Arizona. At 16, I knew that I wanted to join the Peace Corps in 1966, 1 week after receiving my Bachelor of Science degree in accounting from the University of Montana. I started training in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for Peace Corps service in Chile. Of the 30 volunteers who began the program, 22 of us were selected to go to South America. We arrived in Chile that September as part of a group trained to work with savings and loan cooperatives. At the time, Chile was experiencing 30% inflation per year. Officials were trying to get citizens to save money to establish capital so the government wouldn't have to borrow on the world markets. Reducing its international debt would help Chile fight its high domestic inflation. I spent 34 months in Chile working with fishing, mining, agricultural, and consumer co-ops, as well as the SNLs. I prepared numerous financial statements and trained a young Chilean to take over my position when I left. Along the way, I acquired a movie projector and showed movies at elementary schools and met hundreds of friendly Chileans. I left for home on July 20, 1969, the night of the moon landing. I listened to it on a bus crossing the Atacama Desert in northern Chile. I greatly enjoyed my time in South America. My experience taught me to think globally, that the United States is not the center of the world, and that people of all cultures share basic beliefs, hopes, and dreams. And the last story about the Peace Corps comes from Dick Heyman of Langdon, North Dakota. Growing up in the Great Depression, I saw our Langdon farm forced into foreclosure. When I graduated from high school in 1943, my parents had three younger children and needed me to stay home to help buy back the farm. By 1966, my dad had passed away, and I was still here living with my mother. Around that time, I happened to meet a Peace Corps volunteer and began to think about joining. I realized anyone could work this farm, but I wanted a chance to do something that very few ever would. In the early 1970s, to the surprise of everyone I knew, I sold all my machinery and rented out the farm for 5 years. I farmed it again after the lease ended. I was lucky that the Peace Corps was starting a new program that needed farmers. I left for the Philippines in 1973. I would be paid $75 a month in a pilot program that involved working with rural banks to set up loans for local farmers. There were 27 of us. I was 47, the oldest was 66, and the youngest 18. For my first night in Naguilian in La Union province, my assigned Filipino family cooked me a whole fish and watched me eat it. Naguilian had no electricity, limited water, and no phones. It wasn't much different from how I grew up during the Depression years. I soon learned that if you went to someone's home, they would feed you even if they had very little, and they would keep feeding you until you left some food on your plate. For 75 cents, I'd take a bus 150 miles into the capital, Manila. The trip lasted all day, and the bus picked up anyone who flagged it, some of them carrying chickens or pigs. We'd get into the city with people hanging off the sides. It was hot, noisy, and dusty, but it never bothered me. On one of those trips, I met Catalina, or Lena, and her 2-year-old daughter, Leah. Lena and I fell in love and got married. I had to cut my Peace Corps service short after I developed an allergy. Lena and I came home in 1974. I adopted Leah, and Lena and I had a son in 1976. We've been married 47 years. A neighbor once remarked that I must regret joining the Peace Corps. "Think of the money you could have made," he said. I have never regretted it. My wife, daughter, and son are priceless. At 95, I am lucky to have my younger Peace Corps friends, as all my other friends have passed away. Peace Corps volunteers join with high expectations of helping others. That's the main reason I joined. But after it's over, we find that we got as many, if not more, benefits from the experience. And as a side note to those articles, I have some other information for you regarding the Peace Corps. On March 1, 1961, President John F. Kennedy created the Peace Corps by executive order after months of research by his brother-in-law, or Sergeant Shriver, who became the Corps' first leader. 142 host countries served to date. Tanganyika, now part of Tanzania and Ghana, welcomed the first cohorts in the fall of 1961. 240,000 plus total volunteers since inception. They've worked all over the world, but African countries have hosted the most, 45%. Former CIA employees are barred from joining. An assurance to host countries that volunteers are not spies in disguise. Volunteers must be at least 18, but there is no upper age limit for the Peace Corps. Lillian Carter, President Jimmy Carter's mother, joined when she was 68 years old. In 2019, about 3.2% of volunteers were over 50. Richard Nixon mocked it as the Kiddie Corps, and enrollment fell during his presidency. It picked up again under President Ronald Reagan, who expanded the program to include computer literacy and business education. From the Brush with Fame section, Steve Milner of Yorktown, Virginia, submits an article titled Wyatt Earp at Cape Canaveral. While growing up in South Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in the 1950s, I looked forward every week to watching the life and legend of Wyatt Earp. I was a big fan of the show's star, Hugh O'Brien. More than a decade later, I got to work with him when I was a NASA public affairs contractor at the Kennedy Space Center in Merritt Island, Florida. O'Brien ran a youth leadership organization for students interested in community service and science. The foundation organized week-long trips to Cape Canaveral so the students could meet astronauts along with the ground personnel who helped them rocket into space. I coordinated some of the activities for the groups, including setting up photography sessions with O'Brien and the youthful participants for their hometown news releases. When O'Brien visited my building to plan for the influx of students, he generated a lot of excitement. Workers, especially the ladies, clamored to catch a glimpse of the Hollywood star. He was friendly and had a good sense of humor. On one memorable occasion, my wife Enid and I spent time with him socially when we attended a NASA reception honoring those of us whose work supported the space program. The honorees also watched an Apollo manned lunar launch from the VIP viewing area. I was at the Kennedy Space Center for more than 8 years. I'm thankful I had the opportunity to meet and work with O'Brien and his foundation. And here are some facts about Hugh O'Brien. He was born on April 19, 1925, and he died on September 5, 2016. He grew up near Chicago, Illinois. He joined the Marines at 17 and became the youngest drill instructor in Corps history. He played mostly secondary roles in action pictures until he was cast as TV lawman Wyatt Earp in 1955. Volunteer work in Africa inspired him to philanthropic causes, including the Hugh O'Brien Youth Leadership Foundation, established in 1958. From the last section, we have an article titled, Wardrobe Decision Leaves Her in a Bind, and this is submitted by Rosemary Williams of Bridgeport, Connecticut. When I was 17, Bill, a handsome Yale senior, asked me to go with him and another couple to see the circus in New York. I wanted to look chic, gorgeous, and slim, and the fastest way to achieve this in the 1950s was with a girdle. When he picked me up, he smiled and said, "You look very pretty." I thought, success, even if the girdle does pinch a bit. During the long subway ride into Manhattan, I was feeling uncomfortable. By the time we got to Madison Square Garden, I fervently wished I hadn't worn the thing. Metal stays cut into my sides, back, and belly, causing constant pain, which I tried to ignore. We entered at the sideshow, where we talked to the fat lady and watched a sword swallower and jugglers. Then we bought some peanuts to feed to the elephants. We climbed up, up, up to our seats at the very top of the arena. From this vantage point, we could look directly into the eyes of the tightrope walkers. Midway through the show, I could no longer stand it. I whispered to Bill, "Please excuse me, I'll be right back." I stepped over what seemed like hundreds of knees, down, down, down to the ladies' room. I rushed into a cubicle and pulled off the girdle. What now? I had my umbrella with me, so I stuffed it in there. Then I took a deep breath and my body relaxed. Back I went up to our seat and finally began to enjoy myself. It was a great night. Leaving the garden, Bill offered to carry my umbrella, and as we stepped outside, it was raining. Before I could stop him, he opened the umbrella, and the girdle plopped right into a puddle. For a moment, we all stared at it. Then the three of them howled with laughter. Realizing I had to do something, I grabbed the girdle and dropped it into a nearby garbage pail. Soon I was giggling, too. Robert Dussman from Auburn Hills, Michigan, submits an article for the Lasting Impressions section, and it's titled, Weightlifting is the Warm-Up. My friendship with Earl Hook and Dave Keegi began when we were in our mid-teens. I met Earl first when he introduced himself at a ninth-grade football meeting. He was 5'9" and had to look up to talk to me. Dave and I met at track practice. Tall and well-built, he had a gym in his garage, and one day I invited Earl to come along to work out. Pumping iron formed the foundation of a lifelong friendship for the three of us. In 1965, Earl and I were back in Waterford, Michigan, from college. Dave knew he would soon be drafted, so instead of waiting for his number to come up, he decided to enlist. He went to the Air Force Recruitment Center in downtown Pontiac, which had a sign that said, "Back at 1 p.m. The Army and Navy recruiters were also on their lunch break, but the Marine recruiter was at his post, so Dave joined the Marine Corps that day. We spent the summer working, riding Dave's Honda 90 motorcycle to work every day. At night, we cruised in his MG with the top down. The night before Dave left for boot camp, we talked most of the night. I got home just before the sun came up. Dave went to Vietnam in 1966. His dad, Duke, hired me to help with odd jobs. I think having me around helped him cope with Dave's absence. It was painful and traumatic when we learned that one of our high school classmates was killed in Vietnam. Dave was wounded twice during his three tours of duty, and his experience stayed with him. One 4th of July, a firecracker went off near us, and Dave dove for cover. I got married and graduated in 1969. Earl became a science teacher. Dave moved to Arizona and worked a variety of jobs. But not even long separations diminished our friendship. When we were together, we picked up right where we had left off. Earl died in 2019. During weekly visits with him, we had talked for hours about the old days, remembering that long-ago summer when nothing was beyond our reach. And my next article comes from the Classic Cars section, and it's titled Brickyard Tracks Racing's Past, and this is submitted by Russ Makey. One of the jewels in the Triple Crown of auto racing is the Indianapolis 500, which marks its 110th anniversary this year. Its venue, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, was built in 1909 as a test track for Indiana's then-burgeoning automotive industry. The state's historic automakers, Studebaker, Stutz, and Auburn among them, have faded into the past. But the Indy 500 lives on despite a few interruptions, such as during wartime and postponements, most recently in 2020, when the COVID-19 pandemic delayed the race until August 23rd. The track began with a surface of tar-covered gravel, but once races were staged there, the primitive pavement proved quite dangerous, disintegrating in the turns and spattering drivers with debris. Track co-owner Charles Fisher remedied the problem by paving the track with 3.2 billion bricks. Thus was born the track's iconic nickname, the Brickyard. While nearly all of the track has been overlaid in asphalt since then, a 36-inch stretch of brickwork at the start and finish line remains exposed in homage to the track's history. The first Indy 500 winner in 1911 was Ray Heron in the Wasp built by the Marmon Motor Car Company, yet another Indiana auto manufacturer. Heron, who was an engineer, added an innovation to his yellow and black racer that has become standard in all motor vehicles, a rear-view mirror. Heron's win was controversial for two reasons. First, he drove without a mechanic as passenger, then the norm, to monitor oil pressure and act as a spotter. Second, a wreck during the race may have caused scorekeepers to lose count of laps completed by second-place finisher Ralph Mulford. Mulford protested the results, but Heron was declared the winner after a review of the race's limited records. The 500 was the last major race of Heron's driving career. We've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reminisce is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And that number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.